Hello and welcome everyone. My name is Arzu Mosini and it's a great pleasure introducing tonight's program with Klaus Curtis and Carol Dunham. We're here to celebrate the upcoming publication of Scene Written with a discussion and book signing. The book is a collection of essays from the past 20 years written by Klaus Curtis. Artists covered in the book range from Willem de Kooning, Joan Mitchell, and Bryce Marden to Raymond Pettibone, Mark Bradford, and Matthew Ritchie. From 1966 to 1975, under the visionary direction of Klaus Curtis, who co-founded the Bikert Gallery, numerous groundbreaking artists were represented at the gallery, including Chuck Gloss, Barry Leval, and Dorothea Rockburn. Since leaving the Bikert in 1975, Klaus Curtis's achievement as a curator and writer has been extraordinary. He has written for Art Forum, Parkett, Art in America, and several other publications, and has published monographs on Peter Hujar, Joan Mitchell, Bryce Marden, and Jane Freischler. He has curated several major exhibitions, including the 1995 Whitney Biennial, and more recently, the inaugural exhibition, Meditations in an Emergency, held at the Museum of Contemporary Art, Detroit, in 2007. Klaus Curtis received the Lawrence A. Fleischman Award for Scholarly Excellence in the Field of American Art History in 2009. Carol Dunham is an acclaimed artist whose work has been shown in solo exhibitions at galleries and museums worldwide, including Museum Ludwig in Cologne, Germany, Addison Gallery of American Art in Andover, Massachusetts, and Drummond's Museum in Norway. In 2002, New Museum of Contemporary Art in New York launched a major retrospective exhibition of his work. There are several upcoming solo exhibitions in the works for the artist, including the one opening in spring 2011 at Gladstone Gallery Brussels in Belgium. Carol Dunham received the Skowhegan Medal for Distinction in Painting in 2004. I'd like to thank our guests for appearing in tonight's program, marking the 10th event in an art book series, celebrating the essential beauty and importance of art publications with discussions and presentations by world-renowned artists, critics, curators, historians, and writers. Copies of Carol Dunham, Painting, Sculpture, and Larry Pittman, Paintings and Works on Paper with Text by Klaus Curtis, are available for purchase and signing right after the Q&A session at the end of tonight's program. Also reminding everyone in this room of the art and picture collections at Mid-Manhattan Library across Fifth Avenue from here, where you can freely browse one of the most accessible and comprehensive circulating collections containing 40,000 books and videos covering every aspect of art, architecture, and design, and over 1 million pictures covering 12,000 subjects. Thank you all for your attendance, and now it's time to turn the floor to Klaus Curtis and Carol Dunham.
Thank you. Welcome. This is a big pleasure for me because I used to spend so many hours in the art history room doing research, so it's nice to come for another reason. Tip and I are going to kind of chat for a while. I think he has some questions he's going to start with, and we'll go on and at a certain point stop and then see if any of you have any questions or comments.
We said it would be it was billed as a conversation, but it seems that since
it's an interrogation,
Klaus is the one with the book, that I should at least ask him a few questions and see where it goes. Even before we don't have any copies of Klaus's book here, I guess, but I've seen it, and even before I started looking at it, and when I was thinking ahead about our talking, I realized that your career trajectory is quite odd, and no offense. And to me it isn't odd because I've been around it for so long. But you go into it in the introduction about starting the gallery and how your thinking about art sort of grew out of having the gallery, but I'm sure people would be really interested in hearing you talk a little bit about it, because you know, the skill sets of art dealer and writer about art are normally seen to be so different. But in your case, perhaps they weren't.
I started the get. Can you hear? Okay. When I was in college, people kept saying, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I don't really know, but I know I'm going to study art history." So I majored in art history. When I graduated, I went to Europe thinking I would never return, but I did. And I was talked into going back to Yale to graduate school. And I had this really crazy year where I had a full course load. I wrote a master's thesis, and I was a teaching assistant, with the result that I didn't
deep
do,
academia.
I didn't do any of them particularly well. And I had a really incredible advisor for my master's thesis, who was a visiting professor from the Warburg and Courtauld Institute, named Leopold Ettlinger. And he went out on the road to give some lectures and came back, and he had my thesis with him. And he turned to me and he said, "The beginning is really wonderful, but it goes really downhill after that." And I said, "Well, I got really bored with the artist." I was actually the first person in the history of the History of Art Department at Yale to write about a 20th century artist. So with my father's...
Not the last, probably.
Not the last, no. With my father's secretary at my command, I rewrote my thesis in a week and a half and handed it in. And I had, over a number of years, decided... I'd gone from being primary... For a long time, I thought 15th century Florence was the only century I really wanted to be in. And in my last year as an undergraduate, between Robert Herbert and another teacher named George Heard Hamilton, I managed to make it into the 20th century. And so that became more and more serious for me. And I had this idea that I wanted to start a contemporary gallery, because I've always been kind of obsessed with process, and I thought that would get me close.
But what did that mean to you? I mean, I was curious, because process is such a huge part of the frame of reference you use when you write about things. But what did that mean to you, like, as a young man? What is process? What do you think
would,
that even...
It would, like, the hope would be, didn't really happen immediately, that... I would have like pretty daily contact with the work of the artists that I represented, and I'd be in the studio.
But when you did you have a come to Jesus moment about contemporary art, where you saw something that alerted you to the fact that there was something important there for you, or?
Yeah, it was Ralph Humphrey's show. It was the last exhibition at the Green Gallery in 1965. And I really hadn't seen that much contemporary art at that point. And so there was a group of paintings called frame paintings. And they were, for those of you that might not know them, the center of the painting was a very neutral kind of gray, usually put on with a sponge. And then there was a frame. The paintings were maybe 4 by 7 feet, and there'd be a frame, an interior frame going around it that was an off-color kind of muddy pastel, like a salmon-y color or a kind of sooty green or a blue. And I had gone to, it was at the Green Gallery. I'd gone to the Green Gallery once or twice and particularly remembered Lucas Samaras for his show Building a Little House in the Middle of the Gallery and Padding Around in His Underwear. That was Lucas's show. So Ralph's enraged me because I I couldn't understand. Excuse me.
Had someone told you you should be interested in it?
No, I had at the time. There was a man who ran one of the biggest advertising agencies in New York, and he had dealt with me as kind of a surrogate son until his second wife was able to become pregnant. And he always said, "You're going to come work for me." And so when I was through, when I was through with graduate school, I had nowhere to go, and I ended up at this advertising agency, and basically they gave me the rest of my education because I had nothing to do there. I was paid reasonably well. I arrived in my office every day with a little attaché case that had the New York Times and a bathing suit in it, and I read the paper, and then I went up Lexington Avenue to what I think the Shelburne Hotel, and I went swimming with Johnny Weissmuller. And then I would go, I'd spend a goodly part of the rest of the day in, this was, we're talking 1964 here, and you could see all of the contemporary offerings in Manhattan pretty much in a week at that point between 57th Street and Madison Avenue. So I'd either go to the Museum of Modern Art and have lunch and wander around there, or, you know, I'd go up Madison Avenue. And that was really where I learned about contemporary art. I mean, there was no contemporary art. I mean, things at in college more or less stopped around 1950.
So at that point, were you looking for a way to get it into your life somehow?
I mean, there was a good friend from college named Jeff Byers who had once said, you know, he was hoping to open a gallery after he graduated, and I was always kind of jealous because I thought, well, he can afford to do that, and I can't. So after about 2 years of this job in the advertising agency, it began to get a little debilitating because I wasn't doing anything, really, and I was offered a job in Kalamazoo, and I thought Kalamazoo was in Africa, actually. I had no idea it was here. So I was getting kind of discouraged, and I used to have dinner with Jeff and his wife, Hillary, almost once a week, and I kept thinking, well, he knows what I want to do.
Was Jeff an art collector at that time?
Just beginning. So one night at dinner, I think I said how frustrated I was beginning to feel, and I really was looking for somebody who'd back a gallery. And his wife turned to him and said, "You asshole, why don't you do that?" So he said,
"By Kurt."
Yeah, he said, "Okay." So there we were.
Because the thing that's so striking, I mean, I those of you who have known Klaus a long time know this very well, but a lot of you probably don't, that it wasn't like, you know, he worked at an art gallery. It was like Bikert Gallery was an extremely important part of the art scene then. When my friends and I came to New York in the early 70s, it was one of, you know, a tiny handful of galleries where the program was absolutely what we wanted to think about. So that's what I think I see it now as being a more unusual transition than I did at the time, that you could have made such a contribution in that area and still had sort of, you know, your some little version of yourself sitting on your shoulder talking about art writing. I mean, you say in your introduction that you left the gallery right when it was about to become financially viable, which is an interesting time to choose. I would love to hear you talk more about how the writing demon sort of took over from the art dealing demon. You know, I don't even know if you if you've experienced it like that.
I did sort of under duress. I should say to begin with that I was extended an incredible amount of hospitality by the artists because not that many people were going to studios when I was starting the gallery. So there were, you know, and the world was much smaller than it is now. And so much. You know, I could stand there. There was at the opening of the primary structure at the Jewish Museum, like various artists who I'd never met before came up to me and said, "Oh, what are you doing?" And by that time, I'd realized how incredible an artist Ralph Humphrey was, and they weren't as nihilistic as I thought they were the first time I saw them. And I would ask people if they liked Ralph Humphrey, and I was talking to this artist named Carlos Villa, who had the fattest phone book in Manhattan. It was really wonderful, and he turned to me and he said, "Well, so who do you like?" And I said, "Ralph Humphrey." And he said, "Oh, if you like Ralph Humphrey, you'll love Bryce Marden." I said, "Where is he?" "Upstairs." And Bryce was a guard at the Jewish Museum at the time, and so Carlos took me upstairs, introduced me to Bryce, who was sort of leaning against a case of silver, slightly smashed. And I went to his studio the next morning, and I was kind of overwhelmed, and that was sort of...
So having had your experience with the Humphreys must have opened you to that in some way.
It did. I mean, in the end, sounds really corny. I mean, it seemed, the painting seemed so off-putting. And then at a certain point, I came to realize that they were, I mean, all paintings, after you look at them long enough, become a mirror. And somehow the Humphreys began to frame me in a way and ask me to find a context for myself. And they, you know, I still think of them as really amazing paintings. So that was really the beginning of the gallery, the transition out, and or the interest in writing. I mean, I'd written a lot when in prep school. I wrote a humor column full of bad prep school humor, and the dean of students, every week there'd be a pink slip in the auditorium on my seat, and everybody'd be pointing to it going, "You're in trouble, you're in trouble." And he went from wanting to shepherd me through Harvard and be my advisor to trying to get me kicked out of school. So that was that. And Bill Hamilton, who later on went to do endless cartoons for The New Yorker, and I did our class yearbook together.
Did you do, I don't even know if they had things like this then, but did you do creative writing stuff at Yale? Because the first time I realized that you had another life as a writer was really close to when you left the gallery. And I remember asking you about it, and you said you were writing fiction and that you wanted to concentrate on that.
It started earlier. There was that moment in the early 70s where many of us on the art scene became very active politically against the war in Vietnam. And my office looked like a bad Godard movie very often. It was filled with people that were calling Washington
people
regularly.
With beards and berets?
Well, not too many berets, but some beards. And we'd go to Washington in small groups and be photographed in Jacob Javits's office in front of Jasper's flag. We'd go to various senators and tell them they had to help stop the war. And it got very intense, and there was the Art Workers Coalition in Manhattan. And on the fringes, there were some fairly violent and radical people. And one night at a meeting, someone, you know, threatened to... There would be these protests on the steps of the Metropolitan Museum, and someone started yelling, "We should go in and slash paintings." It was really terrifying to me. And there were, you know, there were the Art Workers Coalition decided that artists should put shrouds over their paintings, and I kept thinking of that as really nihilistic. And you were the art was, if anything, was supposed to help you go beyond the war. And by nature, I wasn't terribly political, but I found myself being pulled into this movement and being incredibly active. occasionally people slept in my loft whose name I couldn't know or couldn't be told. And I woke up one morning, this was like a bad Woody Allen movie, and I looked across the Bowery and there was a man with binoculars and a trench coat looking into my bedroom. And I thought, this is really ridiculous. And he was there for about a week every morning, and then one day he knocked on the door.
He knocked on your door?
Yeah, and wanted to know about some of the people who'd come through. And I began to get, like, sort of paranoid, and it was very difficult. And then Linda Bengless and I were living together. She was going to Europe to have a show, and I was supposed to meet her in Paris. And I went to the airport thinking my plane was leaving at 9 o'clock at night, and this was a high travel time in the summer. And it was actually, it had gone at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I was really screwed up. And so I sat waiting to see if I could be on another flight, and there was this little kid on a tricycle, and he kept riding his tricycle into me, and I kept getting really, really angry, and I kept wanting to pick him up and throw him on the ground. And it was just, I couldn't believe how hostile I was getting. And at a certain moment, I just got up. It was like a completely spontaneous reaction, and I went and I bought a pad, and I sat down again, and I started to write.
Wow.
That was the beginning of my actual fiction writing. And I somehow, and Linda hadn't a clue where I was. We had arranged it so that we'd both arrive at the airport in Paris at the same time, which of course we didn't since I missed my plane. And we had no hotel reservations in Paris. Somehow we managed to find each other nonetheless. And I kept writing that summer. And then I went on, and I, you know,
that's you were writing stories.
I was writing short stories. And then I went from there.
Do you feel like that's sort of the where you started to find your voice? Like a style of using words and...
Yeah, you know, I don't think I was... I wasn't so self-conscious about it. I just was writing. And it varied. I mean... The last trip Linda and I took together, she was giving lectures in Australia, and it was after I left the gallery, and they paid for me to come along, and it was pretty dreary because we'd go from town to town, and she'd always give the same lecture. And one night I said, "We've got to go to the water, or I'm going to give your lecture in drag." And there was this really nice couple that offered us their house on the beach, and we had dinner with them, and then the guy said, "Or maybe you'd like to go to the Great Barrier Reef." And I had taken scuba diving lessons in L.A. with a group of people, and so that seemed like a really great idea. So we went to this marine biology station on this island called Heron Island, where all the animals were tame because they were fed daily. And it was scuba diving between the coral, and the incredible variety and color of the fish just completely blew me away. The first story I wrote that I felt really happy about was about that experience. I dedicated it to a young man in this room.
Do you think it's because of the... strikingly visual nature of the experience you had, that it opened something up to you in language?
Certainly there was that, yeah. And I'd written, you know, I mean, you can't study art history without writing papers, and I'd gotten a prize for something or other when I was an undergraduate. It was a really dreadful print was my prize. And I wrote, I didn't really want to become part of the newspaper at Yale, but I convinced them to let me write about exhibitions at the museum.
Oh, so you were writing reviews or something?
Yeah. So I was doing that. And, you know, what kind of...
Because something I think is so striking about your writing, about your writing about art, it's just different from the way anybody else kind of puts language together with objects. It surprises me. I know it, but it still surprises me that you have as much of an academic background as you have, because a lot of art writing feels like that. You know, a lot of art writing feels like the person spent maybe too much time in the library. And your work has a completely, your writing has a totally different tone that's pretty unique. I don't know if you know that.
I do and I don't.
Well, I mean, like in the book, you know, the way you have it, Klass's book is organized in their chunks of essays, sort of three, four different groups. And, you know, you coin a term like oceanicity to talk about a whole way of thinking about painting. And oceanicity is not the same kind of term as institutional critique, you know. It's a different... Or any of the terminology we seem to adopt to shorthand actual thinking.
And I think I've always, I'm not a particularly theoretical person.
Your mic just went off, I think.
Hello?
Oh.
I think it's still on.
You
hear back there? So I've always, I guess, responded physically to what I see, and what do I want when I write about art? I guess the hope is that, you know, I can point to the doorknob to someone who's reading what I've written, and they will open the door a little further for themselves. I don't think, you know, the whole theory of the making doesn't interest me. You know, I'm really almost always getting, you know, like I want to know what the process of the making was for the artist. I want
to
write.
That seems to ground almost all of the things.
It's true. It does. I mean, because it grounds it from my experience. So it's not about revealing secrets or anything like that, but it's just, you know, it's like hopefully letting you see a little of what, how the artist thinks and acts. And in terms of this book, when it was proposed to me, I had previously not wanted to do a collection of my essays because it seemed kind of vain. And I thought, oh, you know, you've reached a certain age, you've done this for so long, you should just do it. And I wanted some kind of loose structure in the book, because a lot of books of essays are just that. It's one essay after the other, and there's nothing holding them together. So the book doesn't have a tight narrative, but the first group of essays are about artists that influenced me as I was forming the gallery or after the gallery had already started. Keith Sonnier, who's sitting there, is one of those artists. Bryce was, Ralph Humphrey was, Alan Sarrett was, and Peter Hujar was, but later. I mean, photography came to me relatively late in my art career. So that sort of gives some of the experience of me going around to studios and looking at work as the gallery was forming. And then the second section is, there's a group show. I had a brief stint before I was fired.
We're not here to discuss that.
No, we don't want to do that. at the Joslin Art Museum in Omaha. And it was sort of an amazing time, because I mean, I'm not a big fan of the Midwest generally, but this is true.
A lot of people in this room probably from the Midwest.
It's true of, like, most cities in America. There's such a hunger for contemporary art. And I got there, and the first thing I did there, I was there partially because of a collector named Phil Schrager, now dead, whom I art consulted for many, many years and put together an astounding collection together with him. And the museum was trying to attract him. So they told him they were going to expand their contemporary program. And he then said, talk to Klaus. So I flew out there and I was hired almost immediately. And at my first dinner, the head of the board put his slimy arms around me and said, I want you to know you can do whatever you want here. We are so happy you are here. And I said, oh, I will remember that. He said, do. So 2 years later, he had me fired because the contemporary art group got to be three times the size of his 19th century group. And I had been the first person ever to get Mutual of Omaha to give a considerable amount of money to the museum for my exhibitions. And it really pissed him off. So the director of the museum called me one day in New York and he said, your program. I said, what about it? He said, we can't go on. I said, why not? he said, we just can't. You have to leave. And I said, when? Now. And so I said, screw you in nastier terms and hung up the phone. And that was the end of my life there. But there was...
But we have the essays.
Don't
have a job, but we have the essay.
We have the essay. There was a group show that, and around that time, I don't know, I was very struck by various artists using narrative in a way and in a very imaginative way. And I decided to do a group show around that, and Tip was in it, and Matthew, who's here, was in it, and Ellen Gallagher, and Neo Rauch and Chris Ofili.
Well, this is actually, it's a perfect example of what I'm talking about with your writing, because that group of artists, which I think I can, as one of them, and I spoke to the others, I think we were all very happy to be seen with each other's work. And it was a premise for an exhibition that somehow no one else ever had. You know, I mean, it seemed so clear when it was there that it made sense. And I was thinking about it, rereading the essays, that why did Klaus think of that, even, that idea of fabulism? Because it wasn't, that idea wasn't around. I mean, you know, I think you're the only one that really had that idea, that it tied together these artists who weren't in it. I mean, they were being tied together maybe in some really loose, generic way, but there was no real thinking going into it. And I think this fabulism is oceanicity is another one. These tools that you come up with through language that allow you to group things together and think about things in a way that's kind of off on your own tangent in a good way.
Yeah, but I just want to say, like, the amazing thing, and the show was really, I have to say, was pretty beautiful. And about 1,500 people showed up at the opening. It was a great experience, and they all, you know, and there were a lot of younger people there. And a lot of people would come up to me and say, are you doing this again? We're so happy. And so I became known in Omaha in my brief tenure there as the Wizard of Modern Art. And my picture was in the paper. People would wave to me if I walked into a restaurant. Omaha is like a small town. If you go downtown, all the restaurants are kind of clustered together. So people would smile, and I'd go, oh, when you get on the airplane, you better drop this, because no one's going to care when you get off the airplane in Manhattan.
The Wizard of Modern Art, right here.
So it was really satisfying to see, you know, like the smallest event that was arranged at the museum that had, you know, a new hanging of something would attract a group of people. I mean, like 150 or 200 people would show up on a weekend to walk through a small exhibition. And that's just immensely, it's really, really gratifying to see something like that. I wouldn't trade in New York for Omaha, but I really loved my experience there, as I did my, I mean, in Detroit, when I did the inaugural show for their Museum of Contemporary Art.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
I went out, you know, almost once a month for a couple of days.
The last piece in Klaus's this collection is an essay Klaus wrote that's about this exhibition that he curated in Detroit. And the thing that I noticed about that essay, because I never saw the show and I haven't been to Detroit in 20 years, is how engaged you seem to be in the place. That had a very different tone than any of the other pieces in the collection, I thought.
New York, well, I it's the first time I ever did a show thinking about the city it was in and the actual venue it was in, the structure it was taking place in. And I had never been in Detroit before, so the first thing that happened is I got put in a car with this artist who was basically a scavenger, and he drove me around the ruins of Detroit. 40% of Detroit, at least, is just totally destroyed. There's this, you know, the most prominent building is this 18-story skyscraper that was built as a combination of railroad station and hotel. It's a really beautiful structure with not a single window or a single copper pipe left. And there's like a 200,000 square foot Packard factory that is just, you know, there's toilets on the ground floor, and a lot of these places have people living in them and scavenging, and it's you take some risk going in because they feel it's their place, not yours. And it was overwhelming to drive around and see this. And nobody, there's so many ruined buildings, and no one needs the land, so they just stand there. When the Super Bowl came to Detroit downtown, they put up like fake facades on a lot of the building because most people don't look up from a car. So if you were at eye level driving through downtown Detroit, everything looked fine. There's this parking garage, now a parking garage, and it used to be a theater. And I was in there and I looked up, and part of the velvet curtain was hanging from the top rung of the parking garage. So it was, there would be these surreal experiences. And at the same time, the city has this incredible energy. I don't think there's many cities in the United States that have as much energy as Detroit does. And it's really hard to figure out where it comes from. A lot, obviously, from the music scene. And there's a fairly lively art scene there, too many art schools. But it feels really good. And then odd things, like in, you know, Manhattan, if you go into most restaurants, you're not likely to see too many African-American people eating at a restaurant that you're in. In Detroit, all the restaurants were integrated. And this being, you know, the site of this major, you know, major upheaval, revolution, as they liked to call it there. So in the building the show was in was a really distressed former car showroom that was three blocks away from the Detroit Institute of Arts, which has a really astoundingly beautiful collection and a great, great Diego Rivera mural that was commissioned by the Fords. And so, and the building was bought by a patron and given to the Detroit Institute of Arts because the director said he needed more space for a contemporary program. And a week after the building was given to him, he called the same patron and he said, "I need $15 million to start the program." And the man said to him, "You'll have to raise that on your own. If you recall, I gave you $40 million last year." So that was the end of the Detroit Institute of Arts in this building, and this group of people asked him if they could have it. So he said he'd give it to them for 4 years, bring it up to code, they'd pay $1 a year rent, and if they were still in existence after 4 years, he'd give them the building, which they're about to get.
So you, the show you curated, which, was the show called Meditations in an Emergency?
It was.
Because that's the name of the essay, is called Meditations in an Emergency.
And it's stolen from a poem by Frank O'Hara that has a completely, that has a sort of love context to it. And it seemed like a perfect title for, you know, this city in distress.
But then at the end of the essay, you sort of imply, if not say clearly, that the emergency is larger than just Detroit.
It, well, yeah, that's certainly true. But, but I wouldn't, you know, a de Kooning show I did opened at the Menil, which is one of my favorite places anywhere. And it looked great there. Anything looks great there, actually. While I was doing it, the sponsoring institution was the Fort Lauderdale Art Museum, and so I never mentioned that to anyone. I always said it's opening at the Menil. But I didn't take Houston or the Menil specifically into consideration as I was building the show. Whereas in Detroit, it became a consideration. And Roxy Payne, who's someone I've never worked with before and whose work I've grown to like quite a bit, he had one of his sculpture-making machines there that looked like an assembly line. I kept trying to find someone who could make a piece of music that wasn't, you know, party music. All these producers kept handing me these tapes, and I said, you know, this is stuff for the opening. I want something that is kind of like a landscape of Detroit. I never quite got that, but there was this young composer, musician, who was obsessed with the beginnings of reggae in Jamaica. I got him $10,000, and he bought all these antique boom boxes, and he built a stand with these boom boxes, and he plays seven or eight different instruments, often plays with local rock groups in Detroit. He's a master musician, and he made these compositions that sound like early reggae. And that was just so ecstatic. And he was, squatting in an abandoned building with, you know, what machinery he had. And there was a woman who worked for Suzanne Hilberry, who has the really only credible gallery out there, who introduced me to him. And I went the next morning hoping he would be black. But it was this nice young white boy. And it blew me away. So that, you know, and it seemed perfect for this exhibition. And at the opening, you know, I kept going back to him and saying, turn it up louder, turn it up louder. And it was, so there was a, Kara Walker had previously been forced to withdraw from an exhibition at the Detroit Institute of Arts. And so Kara was in the show with one of her films, and I had actually the grand dames of the African American community called me to the museum one day to slap my wrist as hard as they could and tell me that I had to use the word revolution, not uprising. And it went on, and that they had to get rid of Kara Walker. They didn't want that in the show. It was demeaning.
It's like having the guy with the binoculars looking in your loft from across the street.
It was something like that. We finally all became friends, but one of them sat down and literally dictated to me changes in the press release that I had written. And they said all their husbands were upset the night before because Mark Bradford was in the show, and with two of his kind of incredible collages, but there was also this goofball videotape that was in a monitor on the floor of Mark wearing a huge hoop and like dribbling a basketball and shooting baskets, but looking pretty ridiculous in the outfit he was wearing. So that was offensive to several of the men. They said it was really
a fashion emergency.
It gave a bad view of black males to, you know, the general audience. So we had a 3-hour session together. At the end, everything was fine, and I didn't have to withdraw Kara Walker from the show. I wouldn't have done that under any circumstances.
But most of what your career through the art world and through your writing hasn't really engaged the political in quite that way.
It has no. I mean, Nary Ward, who when I did the biennial at the Whitney in 95, Nary was in the show. I love Nary. And we flew out to Detroit together, and this building, tiles were falling from the ceiling. The soundproofing was falling off. It was pretty derelict, and Nary was going to build a sort of oasis out of tiles and stuff and then put a shipwreck in there. And then he came back out to Detroit again, and he found this ridiculous monument to the African-American uprising that looked like just a horrible sort of generic corporate sculpture out of, it was just made out of various rectangles of marble. But it was dedicated to, this amazing event in Detroit. And then he made out of detritus that was there in the museum little tea tables. So it was called a white tea room, something. I've forgotten the whole title. Mm-hmm. But so that was clearly totally Detroit-based. And that was, him, Roxy Payne, a little more distantly, but those two certainly,
Is that?
I don't know if
that's
us
doing
that.
How are we making that sound? No.
I do. You want to see my gun, too? Okay. And Paul Pfeiffer had an amazing piece that was about Michael Jackson going on television saying, he never molested young boys, except he had a whole choir mouthing those words. And you'd see one screen with Michael and you wouldn't actually hear his voice, and then you'd hear the choir mouthing the same things. The show was pretty amazing. Barry McGee, who I'd never worked with before, the facade of the building was just totally ordinary, and I thought, God, it'd be great if we could do something with the facade. So I emailed Barry and I sent him a JPEG of the building, and I said, you may not want to work in a situation this funky, but the building's yours if you want the exterior. So he emailed back right away. He said, it's so banal, I can't say no. It was astounding for me to watch him. He came with another graffiti artist named Josh, who was quite intimidating. He was 7 feet tall. He had the most beautiful face, and he never, ever spoke. Barry, the building is maybe 100 feet long, the front facade. And so with a little piece of paper about this size with a drawing on it, he eyeballed like the whole facade. And it was just amazing to watch. He never stopped. And so he perfectly reproduced this drawing that was on the paper, except it was 100 feet long. And then this other character that he brought along built a dummy that was meant to be a portrait of Barry that had a mechanized arm that had a spray can in it, and it hung, the roof was flat, it hung on the ledge of the building. So for days, people would call in and say, someone's graffitiing the facade. And we're calling the cops, or the cops would come and say, there's a report of a graffiti artist. And we had to go to the city council. Actually, there's graffiti all over Detroit and posters, and it's pretty messy. And you had to get permission to do anything. So I was going with a woman who was kind of the head of this group that was putting this museum together. And I said, Marcia, it's a mural. Just remember, it's a mural. And we're going to say Barry is a muralist, and he's in a collection of various museums. And that was, so they said, okay. And so Barry finished the facade, and then he turned to Josh. He said, should we do the side of the building, too? There was this huge parking lot. And he turned to me and said, can we do that? I said, okay. And so they did the same thing on the side. And kids had heard that he was coming. And not a lot, but there were about, 15 or 20 kids there at one point who adored, Barry McGee, who's known as Crash in the graffiti world. And it's still there. It's a little faded.
So is it a sort of landmark to people?
I mean, it was. I don't think it is anymore. I mean that. It's kind of faded. It's got to be 3 or 4 years ago now. But it was, it was terrific when it happened, and it was a great experience for me to watch it. So, and the artists, John Polipchuk built a piece that was made up of detritus that he'd found out there with sort of little miniature derelicts drinking beer.
But it sounds like a kind of different project than other things. I mean, it sounds very different from other things you've been involved with.
It was.
Which is sort of what it felt like when I, as a piece of writing, too. You know, like it gets into areas of sociology,
yeah.
And even the way you talk about the experience, it's quite different.
It was less pure, there was an artist from James Cohan, Tabaimo. Am I pronouncing her name right? Where's Arthur?
Yeah, that's correct.
Who's this amazing animator and had this just incredibly beautiful animation that they showed at James's gallery, and that was there, and that was sort of the least Detroit-sensitive piece in the show. But everybody, and the amazing thing, I said this before to you, when, the COO, it was threatening not to be there in time for the opening. So there were all these artists and art students in Detroit that volunteered to work in the museum to get it prepared and finished. And they'd be there for like almost a whole week every morning till 2, sometimes 3. And I just couldn't believe that they were willing to do all this work. And every night, we'd go through the same routine. I'd sort of be standing there on the verge of tears and going, you guys are amazing, thank you. And they'd go, oh no, we have to thank you. We've been waiting years for something like this to happen. And the artists were, John Polipchuk was running around, Detroit, Detroit, it's the new Berlin, it's the new Berlin. And people have come out there, since then. I mean, Clarissa Dalrymple and Billy and I flew out, and together with Linda Yablonsky, who wanted to see the show. And Linda Yablonsky has now become, a dedicated Detroit fan. And countless people who've gone out there come back and say, what an amazing experience it is to be there. So it was, and I've never, and the space was so large. It was like 20,000 square feet. Usually when you do a group show, somebody comes up and says, she got the best wall. And they're really pissed off. So nobody could do that in this show because there were so many big walls and so much space. That never happened, and it felt very communal somehow. There were three of
these. Yeah, it sounds like a very collaborative, very sort of organically happening,
yeah,
out of the participants' interests. We've been talking for almost an hour, so is there anything you'd like to unburden yourself about before before we throw this out to the group?
Oceanicity. I have this thing. I don't know how to document this properly, but Jackson Pollock is. I've never actually written a full essay on Jackson Pollock.
And, or on Cy Twombly, as you mentioned in your introduction.
They're two of the artists I most admire. And the Oceanicity came about because I worked for a while at the museum, the Parrish Art Museum in Southampton, and Trudy Kramer, who was the new director, and I had kind of turned it into a viable institution instead of merely the venue for the annual summer benefit to be photographed by Bill Cunningham. And they were having their 100th anniversary, and Trudy had hired a complete asshole as a curator, and he was fired. And she said, "We need someone to do a show in his place. Would you do it?" And I said, "Okay." And then I thought, well, what would the topic of my show be? And I moved. I built a house in East Hampton in 1973 because the ocean is really important to me, and it is to my partner, Billy, as well. And I wanted to be, the house is 7 miles from the ocean and 7 miles from the bay, so it's not like we trot down the dune in the morning. but
don't spoil their image. Let them imagine your...
It's really been an important part of my life, and so I thought I would do a show about the importance of the ocean to American modernism starting in the 19th century. So that's what I did. It's one of, if I say so myself, one of the most beautiful shows I've ever done. And I got the most incredible loans, a goodly number of them from Andover, because Jock Reynolds just said, okay. I said, "Jock, they have this little Pollock called Phosphorescence that is so beautiful." And phosphorescence is a phenomenon that happens around the ocean and in the ocean. And I said, "Jock, I'll crawl across the campus on my knees if I can have that painting." And he said, "It's already committed to the Pollock retrospective, but I'm so angry at them because they wouldn't loan me something that I wanted to borrow." He said, "You can have it until normally these paintings would all be collected at the Modern and they'd be looked at by registrars and conservators." And he gave me the painting for half the show. And I got to hang it next to an Albert Pinkham Ryder. And everybody knows that Ryder was one of the few artists Pollock would say anything nice about. But there was something so thrilling to actually physically be able to pick up these two paintings and put them next to each other. And Jock also loaned us one of the great Homers in the Addison Gallery. They were just these incredible things. And the museum had no proper climate control at that point.
You mean the parish?
The parish. And the show ended with... We can't go into the toll saga of Raymond Pettibone, but Raymond did a 25-foot wall of a surfer on a wave. That was, Barbara knows this story pretty well. That was the end. That was sort of the finish of the show. So, and I become convinced that Pollock was partially catalyzed to make his drip paintings from watching breaking waves at the ocean. I'm not a photographer, on my cell phone, started trying to take pictures of breaking waves this past summer, but I didn't get very far, and I keep thinking there's got to be a slide lecture here comparing, details of Pollock with breaking waves.
Well, I think what's really... and maybe this is a place we could sort of turn to you guys if you have questions for Klaus, but the fact that, when you were just describing the show and you talked about it as being about the importance of the ocean to American modernism, that's certainly true, but the thing that is sort of, I think, special about the way your thinking works is that it isn't... only you're not only using the ocean as a subject, you're also using the ocean as a kind of, as a thing to sort of riff on. You know, it's a metaphor, it's an analog, it's not only, you know, a painting of the ocean.
Yeah, there's that, I mean...
And you're comfortable moving through those different relationships, you know, of...
They sort of suggest themselves in a way... I mean, I never had really paid any attention to John Maron when I started working at the museum, because they have so many Fairfield Porters. And, you know, Porter wrote really articulately about art as well. And one of the artists he really admired was John Maron. So I ended up doing the first ever exhibition of John Maron's oil paintings, which was his main occupation after 1930 until his death in 1953. And John Maron had this, you know, and he said, when painting the water, paint like the water. I think one could say that. Certainly you can see that in, I mean, late Maron paintings, which Maron at that point was considered the number one artist in America, and, you know, Pollock was to take his place. But Maron certainly had some impact on Pollock's work. But that kind of, you know, trying to, like free a wave inside yourself, I think was really important to Pollock somehow. But there's no, and I ask, Ruth Kligman is not an authority that too many people like to quote. and I asked Ruth once, you know, I said, well, when you and Jackson were together, did he draw in the sand? Did he look for phosphorescence? Of course he did, and yes, he drew in the sand. So he was at the beach a lot, and it was part of his life in a way. So I could be exaggerating the possibility, but it's very...
Well, I hope you explore it more.
Yeah, I would like to.
Shall we see if anyone else has anything they'd like to ask? What do you think? Yeah, I think we should. Do you guys have any questions for him?
What's next? The thing I'm most excited about is I'm doing a Matthew Barney drawing exhibition at the Morgan Library in 2013. And
that will presumably involve some writing?
Yes. There's likely, I mean, we've sat and had preliminary conversations about what would be in the catalog, and I would write an essay, and Matthew has become, like, very friendly and fond of Ronnie Horn, because he's in Iceland quite a bit, and Ronnie will write something, and I've forgotten the name of the man who wrote in the Schellager catalog, who had that interview with Matthew. What's his name? Who's a psychoanalyst? And so he will write something as well. So there'll be three essays and an incredibly beautiful show. More?
This question is actually for both of you. How did you and Carol originally meet?
Carol Dunham?
Yeah.
I was working for an artist that showed in Klaus's gallery.
Who will go nameless?
I was Dorothea Rockburn's studio assistant, and she showed at Klaus's gallery, and Klaus was one of the adults that was always nice to me, though he wasn't such an adult. I mean, I was 22 and he was 32 or something.
But I have to say that Tip, it's been one of the great pleasures of my life on the art scene. I got to watch Tip develop and grow from his really early tentative beginnings into the astounding art that he's made for the last 25 or more years. And we've also become good friends, and I value him immensely. I thank you for doing this.
An honor. We've known each other a long time, and we've gone through a lot of different, you know, chapters of this whole art thing. So.
And we're still here. Were you going to ask something?
I was going to ask what your thesis was.
I'd rather not say. It was, you know, my advisor, his name was Leopold Ettlinger. He, one of the most beautiful people I've ever been around. And he had so much knowledge about so many different things, and he was.
Is he the one that told you you were going to be a whore if you were an art dealer?
No, that was the head of the department. Oh. I was like a lot of sort of still almost adolescent people. I was very smitten with Paul Klee, but you couldn't write a master's thesis on Paul Klee in 1 year because you just couldn't find the topic. And so in the Société Anonyme collection at Yale, there is a minor member of the Blue Rider group named Heinrich Kampendonk, who had never been written about. And so he became the subject of my thesis. And he went through the same kind of stylistic early development that Klee did, so that satisfied me in some way and kept me engaged. And then when I got beyond that, the work, the Guggenheim owns 3 or 4 paintings. Occasionally you'll see one up. It's pretty dreary stuff. So Professor Ettlinger, he was, amongst other things, the first person that broke the anti-Semitic barriers of the Yale History of Art departments. His wife left after 3 days and turned to him and said she could not live in an atmosphere like that. And he persevered for the year. And he was everybody adored this man. But when I said, well, it would be a possibility for a thesis, he said it would be an ideal master's thesis topic. No one's ever written on it before. And I spent hundreds and hundreds of dollars calling his daughter every month in Germany and trying to get information out of her. And it was, it's buried in a vault at Yale, I'm happy to say.
Be there for 1,000 years.
Yeah. Yes.
I've been looking at a lot of images behind the both of you, and I noticed that we see work of yours, as well as Matthew Ritchie's, but we've also been looking at works by Albert Olin. And I was just wondering, because you've spent a lot of time talking about American modernism into contemporary setting in America, how does Albert Olin's more recent paintings find their way into the backdrop of the discussion?
I mean, both Tip and I admire him, and I've written on him, like, pretty extensively. There's a book that Toshin has done that now only exists in its luxury edition. It's about this high and suitable as a coffee table.
How much is it, $1,000?
And it costs $1,000. It's a little horrifying.
So run out and get that book.
And I have... A fairly lengthy essay in that book.
And actually, on that book, and it's wonderful. But I'm just wondering.
Do you really?
You don't have a copy with you, do you?
You could express an idea of European painting in relationship to, say, painters in Germany or Britain or other people.
I feel like Albert's extended the possibilities of abstract painting in some way. Clearly, when you look at the images of his paintings, Rauschenberg has been important for him, his relationship to Kippenberger in Germany. And I keep calling it sort of synthetic gesture. There are artists, I mean, here in America, like Jacqueline Humphreys, Josh Smith, I think preeminently Erland, that have used, you know, the expressionist gesture as a found object, you know, and at the same time made really beautiful paintings. And Albert's, I don't see him too often, but he's become a friend as well. I think he's a really terrific artist.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Well, thank you for coming.
Okay.